TKE is OUT. ASU has handed down its penalty for the France Martin Luther King theme party. How's the controversy playing on campus?
I'm concerned that your fraternity is transforming into an echo chamber for racism. And I'm concerned that not a man stood among you brothers with the foresight to predict the shame such an event would bring your organization.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Today on the show, a recap of the sanctions and what's still to come. A retailer is marketing an energy drink to high school athletes. Cool or not cool?
State lawmakers create controversy by trying to repeal a controversial law. Intel's new plant is done and ready to go. It just has to put something in it.
When you look at what Intel was planning for Chandler, I don't think they figured that the PC market and demand for PC processors would decline so quickly.
Plus, early age memory making, donating citrus, and eating pizza.
That and more ahead on the show after a check of this hour's news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. New signs of hope for face-to-face meetings between rival factions in Syria's civil war this day. Lakhdar Brahimi, the UN mediator at the Center of Syria Peace Talks in Geneva, says delegates representing the Syrian government and the main opposition have agreed to be in the same room tomorrow. Brahimi spoke to reporters after emerging from separate meetings with each side.
The discussions I've had with the two parties were encouraging, and we are looking forward to our meetings tomorrow morning and tomorrow afternoon.
Delegations from around the world gathered in Switzerland this week to figure out a way to end nearly 3 years of conflict in Syria that has claimed more than 130,000 lives and driven millions of people from their homes. Brahimi says the Geneva talks may last a week. A new wave of violence has struck a number of Egyptian cities, altogether claiming at least 17 lives and wounding scores of people. Blood was shed in clashes between Muslim Brotherhood supporters and Egyptian police. But as Mara Kennedy reports from Cairo, some of the first casualties today occurred during a spate of bomb blasts in the capital.
The largest bombing happened at daybreak in front of the Cairo Security Directorate, a key police institution. There have been four today, in front of a metro station, a police station, and now a movie theater. These are the latest in a string of attacks since Mohamed Morsi was ousted from power in July. With bombs going off in the capital city, it's a major escalation on the eve of the third anniversary of Egypt's revolution. Both supporters and opponents of the coup plan to demonstrate. The Muslim Brotherhood denounced the attacks and called on supporters to rally in peaceful protests around the country. In some areas, there were clashes. Meanwhile, interim President Adli Mansour vowed that Egypt will, quote, uproot terrorism without pity or mercy. For NPR News, I'm Merrick Kennedy in Cairo.
The former governor of Virginia and his wife are pleading not guilty to federal corruption charges. NPR's Allison Keyes has the latest.
Are you going to plead, Governor?
Robert and Maureen McDonald didn't have much to say as they entered the courthouse this morning to face a 14-count indictment. McDonald was once considered a potential Republican presidential candidate, but prosecutors accused the couple of using his position as governor to enrich himself and his family by soliciting more than $135,000 in loans, gifts, golf outings, and a Rolex from Johnny Williams, the former CEO of dietary supplement maker Star Scientific. Earlier this week, McDonald said he and his family did nothing illegal.
While I deeply regret accepting these legal gifts and loans from Mr. Williams, all of these now have been returned or repaid with interest.
The McDonald's face decades in prison and fines of over $1 million. Allison Keyes, NPR News.
Before the closing bell, Dow is down more than 300 points, nearly 2% at 15,879. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Lemelson Foundation, supporting inventors and invention to improve lives in the U.S. and developing countries. On the web at lemelson.org.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Seeing some cloudy skies out there this afternoon. Those will stay with us through most of the evening. We expect overnight lows to be around 50. And then for this weekend, partly to mostly sunny skies. High temperatures again well above normal in the mid-70s. Right now it's cloudy and 67 degrees.
In the news this hour, a California man faces more than two dozen felonies after authorities say he attacked the driver of a Greyhound bus early yesterday morning as it traveled down I-10. That caused the bus to go off the road, injuring 24 passengers. The 25-year-old man from L.A. is charged with endangerment, aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, aggravated assault involving temporary disfigurement, and criminal damage. The public defender's office says the man does not yet have an attorney. His next court appearance is scheduled for January 30th.
A Navajo Nation counsel Council committee has voted against legislation to remove Council Speaker Johnny Nayes because of pending bribery and conspiracy charges. The Daily Times reports the committee voted twice to table the legislation, but it'll still advance to the Council's winter session, which starts Monday in Window Rock. Supporters say the measure is intended to preserve the integrity and image of the Council Speaker. Nayes has said he will not step down and that he did nothing wrong. He's serving his second consecutive two-year term as Speaker.
Authorities say an inmate at the Lewis State Prison Complex in Buckeye assaulted and injured a corrections officer before being restrained. Arizona Department of Corrections officials say the inmate hit the officer several times in the head and body this morning. Guards in a tower then fired two non-lethal rounds at the inmate before he was restrained. Corrections officers say the officer was taken to a hospital for treatment and that the inmate was also transported for medical evaluation. Details were not released. The unit where the assault occurred was placed on lockdown.
Less than a week after holding a controversial Martin Luther King Jr. Day themed party, the Tau Kappa Epsilon fraternity's fate at Arizona State University has been determined. KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block is with us. Jude, what was the final decision?
ASU put out a press release on Thursday night saying, and they had promised to take action by the end of the week. And so they've permanently revoked recognition of this fraternity, which means this frat, Tau Kappa Epsilon, won't be at ASU anymore. It's actually been suspended till 2016 in University of Arizona in Tucson. So really, this fraternity in Arizona is at NAU right now and, you know, going strong there, I guess.
And they laid out some very specific reasons. Some was related to this party, but obviously there were other factors as well.
They laid out actually four specific violations as the basis for, permanently banning the fraternity. Those included they had violated their disciplinary, their previous disciplinary sanction. They were on probation. They weren't supposed to have parties. They had an environment with alcohol for underage drinkers, and they also had engaged in discriminatory activities. So, really, the substance of the party theme did have a big role here.
So we know what's happened to the fraternity, but Michael Crow and some others are also looking into what's next for the students who took part.
Right. So the statement says ASU is still investigating members of the fraternity and other students who were actually at the party. And we don't know what kind of discipline those students will get. We have a statement from President Michael Crow explaining that the ASU Student Code of Conduct lays out certain standards and that, you know, that sanctions when you violate these standards are in order. So we'll see what happens.
KJZZ reporter Jude Joffe Block.
And less than 30 minutes ago, TKE's national office issued a statement apologizing for the actions of what it says were a few members involved in the incident. TKE says the MLK party wasn't an official fraternity event. It also claims some of the offensive photos being used by media outlets were actually from a 2012 Halloween event and an, quote, earlier sports-themed function.
To the brothers of Tau Kappa Epsilon, admittedly, I write this letter with regret.
Jahan Jones is president of the African American Men of ASU.
A man hopes to come in contact with another man only for purposes of solidarity, unity, and love. Having been made aware, however, of your most recent act of denigration toward the African American community, I find myself in your mailbox or on your computer screen for purposes much less fortunate. I write now with no intent to reprimand or defame, but to ask with the utmost sincerity, why? The legacy of the African American Men of ASU is one from which my constituents and I derive an incomparable pride. The organization continues in its pursuit of improved retention rates for African American males and, more largely, the cultural consciousness of ASU's African American community. This, again, is our legacy. I am concerned, however, that your legacy is enduring an almost irreparable damage. I am concerned that your organization's self-professed mission to, quote, aid men in their mental, moral, and social development for life eludes you with such heinous acts as your most recent MLK Black Party. I am concerned that your fraternity is transforming into an echo chamber for racism. And I'm concerned that not a man stood among you brothers with the foresight to predict the shame such an event would bring your organization. To be fraternal is to be of or akin to brotherhood. To be brothers in the context of organizational fraternity ought to be more a celebration of manhood than a celebration of maleness. To celebrate the beauty of manhood is to celebrate the character traits so necessary for a man to fulfill his responsibilities. To celebrate maleness is to parade oneself as a caricature of manhood. Much of my work with the African American Men of ASU is concerned with clarifying this difference. In fact, at their foundations, much of the work of ASU's numerous other fraternities is concerned with clarifying this difference. I can only hope that you, too, will one day make this your goal. Sincerely, Jahan Jones, President of the African American Men of ASU.
There's a ballot box battle brewing at the state capitol. Last year, you may recall, lawmakers approved a controversial election law, which, among other things, changed who can turn in early ballots and how many signatures it takes for some parties' candidates to get on the ballot. House Bill 2305 prompted critics to collect enough signatures to put the law up for a vote this November. Now the legislature is considering repealing last year's law, which would head off this fall's referendum. State Senator Michelle Reagan heads up the groups formed to defend the law. The Scottsdale Republican says she's very much in favor of repealing the law and keeping it off the ballot.
I wrote many parts of 2305, so I like the policy behind it, but I think that this was an unintended consequence when they went to go, when opposition groups went and got signatures to put it on the ballot to repeal it. I don't know that anybody realized that it going on the ballot makes everything voter protected. And because it's such a large bill and it covers so many areas, the thought of that all being locked and the legislature being unable to change any of it ever, I don't think serves Arizona voters, no matter what party they're in.
Well, so some of these opposition groups, as I'm sure you know, are suggesting that this repeal is basically trying to circumvent the opportunity for Arizonans to vote on this issue. I mean, I'm guessing that you don't see it that way.
No, I'm seeing it the way that we've never had a referral since the implementation of Proposition 105.
The Voter Protection Act, as it's
Correct.
More commonly called.
So this is uncharted legal territory.
How many of the provisions of 2305 do you expect to see in separate bills this year?
Well, I have asked that we don't do any in separate bills this year, which is hard for me to do because, like I said, I was a very big supporter of this package. But the fact is we do need to respect the will of all of those people who signed the petitions to put it on the ballot. And we, by respecting them, by saying they didn't like this law, they were uncomfortable with it, so let's go ahead and repeal it. I disagree with the sentiment that some of my colleagues have that, well, let's repeal it, but then let's just replace provisions of it separately. That, to me, is a slap in the face to voters.
So given the fact that you chair the Senate Elections Committee, presumably any bill that would be in reference to something that had been in HB 2305 would come through your committee. Would you not give it a hearing, given that you wouldn't want it to become law?
You know, that's something that I've been having discussions with Senate leadership about. So that would be my initial response would be, yeah, I mean, that's not my preferred option, is to have to piecemeal this and to circumvent kind of what I see as the will of 147,000 people who signed those petitions. I've been trying to talk to as many people in the House and Senate as possible to say, let's focus on repealing this and get it off the books. And let's all just walk away and take a breather before we start doing that. So I'm hoping that they listen and that I'm not put in that position. Because remember, a lot of those pieces in that bill were actually some of my bills. So it would be very hard for me to hold things that I actually wrote last year.
State Senator Michelle Reagan. Referendum supporters are not excited about the attempt to repeal the law. Julie Earfley chairs the Protect Your Right to Vote Committee, which worked to refer the law to the ballot.
I know that the goal is to repeal it, and that would make all of us ecstatic if that's what they wanted, to actually just repeal 2305. Unfortunately, members of the Republican caucus have already made it crystal clear that they don't actually wish to repeal it because they know it's a bad idea. They want instead to repeal it so that they can then re-implement it piece by piece in separate bills.
So a few of the people who supported the bill last year and now support the repeal this year have said, we have no intention of reintroducing any provisions. Senator Michelle Reagan has said that, you know, it's her belief right now that if any of those bills come before her committee in the Senate, that she wouldn't want to give them a hearing. It sounds like you don't necessarily believe that that's what's going to happen.
I don't believe it because they've also said in other publications that, in fact, the goal is to reintroduce parts of this bill. And while I believe it's possible they may not reintroduce them in this year's session, definitely the goal is to introduce them in next year's session. And I think the reason they would delay that is because they know that there would be a legal challenge. And it's also a good way to allow some time to lapse so perhaps the voters forget that they've already gone through this fight.
Is there any concern among supporters of the referendum that some of the less controversial provisions of 2305, if the bill is defeated in November, if it's on the ballot, that those provisions would become voter protected and things that might be an okay thing in your mind to actually enact wouldn't be able to be enacted without a separate vote?
No, actually, because we're not even sure if that's true. I mean, there's a lot of disagreement right now on whether the Voter Protection Act would actually apply to that, mainly because it's not really been challenged in the courts. There just isn't much legal history on this.
At this point, what is your level of optimism that Arizona voters will, in fact, vote on this in November?
Well, I'm not completely optimistic that the legislature is going to let this go to the voters. I wish that I was more optimistic that they would let the voters have their say. Unfortunately, they've done an incredible job of ensuring that the voters don't get to have their say. But I think with all of the pressure and with all of the people who are standing up and saying we want our voices heard, I think we have a better than 50% chance, I would say, that, you know, that this does get to the voters.
Should lawmakers approve the repeal and then approve some of the provisions separately that were in last year's bill, do you think that you would be able to work the same coalition to try to get that to get those provisions on the ballot?
I think that's possible. Clearly, that would be much more difficult, particularly if they did that in a series of bills, for instance, four different bills. You know, as you may know, to get a referendum, to get a bill referred to the ballot, it is a much more difficult process. It's been, I believe, almost 30 years since this has happened, other than 2305. So this is a very rare occurrence.
Julie Earfley, chair of the Protect Your Right to Vote Committee. A state House committee was scheduled to vote on the repeal yesterday, but the bill was held. That delay, however, will probably be a short one. It's back on the Judiciary Committee's agenda for next week.
Earlier this month, Intel announced it would delay the opening of a massive $5 billion factory in Chandler. Then a few days later, the computer chip maker made headlines again when it said it would cut more than 5,000 jobs from its global workforce. KJZZ's Peter O'Dowd explains what's going on.
As far as factories go, this one was about as ballyhooed as they come. In 2012, President Obama visited Intel's Ocotillo campus in Chandler the day after his State of the Union address.
Because honestly, first of all, who wants to miss out a chance to see the crane? That thing is huge.
Mr. Obama stood beneath a towering crane at the construction site, a crane so big it could lift 4,000 tons. The president then boasted that Intel's factory, known as Fab 42, would someday crank out high-powered computer chips for laptops and phones and keep good jobs on American soil.
The factory that's being built behind me is an example of an America that is within our reach, an America that attracts the next generation of good manufacturing jobs, an America where we build stuff and make stuff and sell stuff all over the world.
Oh, what a difference 2 years make. I'm not far from the very spot where the president spoke. That multi-billion dollar factory he was raving about is finished, but there's nothing happening inside it. I asked Intel to join me here, but instead they sent me a statement that said the new factory space would be set aside for future use. Many of the 1,000 or so jobs the project was supposed to have created have been relocated to other buildings on this sprawling industrial complex.
When I think about Intel, it's a company in transition.
Morningstar analyst Andy Ng follows the semiconductor industry. He says Intel hit headwinds when demand for personal computers plummeted in favor of tablets and mobile phones. Indeed, the company's stock has seen virtually no growth since the day Mr. Obama made his visit to Arizona.
When you look at what Intel was planning for Chandler, I don't think they figured that the PC market and demand for PC processors would decline so quickly.
The problem is that 60% of Intel's business comes from the microprocessors inside PCs. The company said this month that revenue would be flat in 2014, and that's a big reason for the 5% haircut in its global workforce by the end of the year.
Remember, this is a big organization too, right? So you can't just right the ship overnight.
But after years of losing ground, some industry experts believe Intel has recognized its imbalance. Ng says it's transitioning well into the race for smartphones and tablets. He sees potential in the company's push for building cloud storage and server capacity for the crush of new mobile devices popping up around the world. And there's something else.
There's one fork in the road for Intel that it is thinking about going down.
Roger Kay follows the industry with Endpoint Technologies Associates.
And that is becoming a foundry or making parts for other companies.
Kay says Intel has the industry's most advanced manufacturing techniques, and smaller chip designers without the same expertise would pay to fill some of the empty factory space in Arizona. Still, Kay says this potential doesn't take the sting out completely.
I imagine that neither Obama nor Intel would like to be reminded of that day when they proclaimed the factory the greatest thing since sliced bread for the American public. It's true, it's kind of a setback.
For its part, Intel won't say when it plans to remove the mothballs from Fab 42, but the company does point out that a $300 million research building will open nearby within 6 months. Peter O'Dowd, KJZZ News.
Still to come, we head to another of the valley's hot corners with an international flair.
There's a lot to do. You've got a lot of choices. You can go to Jamaica, you can go to Italy, or you can just stay American here.
Leave your passport, but bring your appetite. It's the show.
Mark, I hope I'm not about to jinx anyone, but it's 2:20 on a Friday afternoon, and there are no traffic accidents to report. Uh-oh, I'm sorry. Also, we've got cloudy skies this afternoon, which has been a little bit different of late. Also, it's a little bit cooler than we've seen, but it'll just be one day of below normal temperatures. Then this weekend, we'll have partly to mostly sunny skies. Highs both Saturday and Sunday around 75, currently cloudy, and 67 degrees at KJZZ.
KJZZ is supported by Virginia G. Piper Charitable Trust, helping children to become strong readers through Read On Arizona. More at pipertrust.org/literacy.
It takes a forklift to pick up one of the big cardboard boxes of citrus fruit at St. Mary's Food Bank in Phoenix.
It's going to get a little frosty in here.
The oranges, grapefruits, and lemons are kept in a cooler in the food bank warehouse.
Grapefruits are huge. They're bigger than softballs, most of them.
There are only a couple of boxes here right now, but tomorrow the cooler will fill with donations from around the valley during Super Citrus Saturday. If you have extra citrus from around the yard, you can drop it off at one of four locations around the valley. St. Mary's spokesman Jerry Brown says the annual event brings in tons of ripe fruit.
We've gotten in excess of 100,000 pounds from past Super Saturdays. Last year, it was the rainiest day for the entire year. We still received 48,000 pounds on that day. So we're hoping a combination of 73-degree weather and very bountiful harvests on fruit trees this year, that's going to combine for our most successful drive ever.
The drop-off locations are in what Brown calls the valley's richest citrus areas. That's the Central Corridor, Arcadia, North Scottsdale, and in the West Valley near Surprise and Sun City.
There are a lot of areas that were citrus groves to begin with, and they kind of built home developments around the citrus groves.
If you grow a lot of citrus, there are benefits to donating beyond the satisfaction of giving back. For instance, less food in the backyard means less food for unwanted critters, like roof rats.
It is important to get that fruit off of your trees, especially if you're in a well-developed and older area. Those roof rats really, really enjoy that. They hide up in the roofs of the houses and they come down and feed at night.
And as temperatures rise, the fruit will rot. To make sure St. Mary's fruit donations don't go bad, the food bank will be juicing some of it with the help of a Tempe juicing company. St. Mary's will freeze the juice in gallon containers and will give those out through early summer. This will be especially helpful because St. Mary's can't trade citrus with neighboring states for other goods like it's been able to in the past because of a citrus quarantine.
As for the fruit that isn't juiced, Brown says it's a fresh staple for the emergency food boxes.
We always try to augment with whatever we have, and fruits and vegetables are a great part of that because those are the things that are the most difficult to buy because they're most expensive in the store.
The fruit will also go to areas in the state where citrus doesn't grow in every backyard, like Flagstaff. Super Citrus Saturday runs from 9 to 2 tomorrow. Exact drop-off locations can be found online at firstfoodbank.org.
Hey guys.
U2, Michael Jackson, Adele. In the annals of the Grammy Awards, these are the kinds of names we typically associate with the awards. But every one of those artists was inspired by someone, usually a teacher. That's where Catherine Coons comes in. The former Horizon High School teacher and choral director is one of 10 finalists for Music Educator of the Year in the country in the Grammy Awards.
When the nomination first came out, I found out there was something like 30,000 teachers nominated from across the country. And quite a lot of my colleagues from all around the country were posting on their Facebook something like that, oh, so honored to have been nominated for this Grammy Award. And I just kind of lumped myself right in there with everybody who had an adoring student or a supportive parent or whatever. And then a few months later, found out that I was in about the top 300. And so basically, progressively, this went on over the course of almost the entire year. And each time that there was a cut, they required more and more, whether it was an interview or a video or something that you would submit to them, showing your classroom, showing performances, testimonials, things like that. Then eventually ended up making it to the top 10, which was overwhelming and humbling. And yet bittersweet, because last year my husband found out that he had to change jobs and our family ended up having to move here to Indiana. And I had been teaching in Arizona for 17 years and had been at my school for 13 of those. And, you know, it was just so much more than a job. Those students were my family and my colleagues, and the parents were such an incredible support. It was really, really difficult to leave.
How concerned are you, as many in the community and various communities are, about the de-emphasis on arts education, music education? How much are we losing without that?
I almost can't think of anything worse for the education system than to take those kinds of things away. I have seen firsthand students who literally only get out of bed and come to school every day because of their arts and music classes. We would go on trips and we would compete various places. Well, the no pass, no play rule affected my students just as much as it affected the athletes. So many of my students were literally passing their academic classes and barely graduating by the skin of their teeth because they wanted to make it to the choir performances and things. I mean, it was like a motivation for some of those kids that maybe were not academically as gifted.
Catherine Coons, she was music teacher and choral director at Horizon High School in North Phoenix for the past 13 years, and she's one of 10 finalists for the inaugural Music Educator of the Year at the Grammys. The winner will be officially awarded on Sunday.
In less than 3 weeks, the Winter Olympics will open in the Russian city of Sochi. Last-minute preparations are underway as Russia prepares to show off before the world with the most expensive Winter Olympics ever. But opinions among the residents of Sochi are perhaps more divided, as the BBC's Steve Rosenberg discovered on a visit to a city which, metaphorically at least, has come in from the cold.
On the Black Sea, there is one town Russians have been singing their hearts out about since communist times. Sochi is where the Soviets exchanged their hammers and sickles for buckets and spades, where everyone from Communist Party functionaries to factory workers flocked for a little sun, sea, and Russian Riviera. And yet, in less than 3 weeks, this subtropical paradise with its promenades and its palm trees will host a Winter Olympics. Make sense of that one. There's still construction going on here, but most of the venues are now ready. The Olympic motto is faster, higher, stronger. But looking at all the glitzy new arenas, Russia's Olympic motto seems to be bigger, shinier, and more expensive. If you add up what's been spent on sports venues and infrastructure, like new roads, railways, and hotels, the final bill is expected to exceed $50 billion. That would make these the most expensive Olympics in history. But Russian TV presenter Irada Zainalova believes Russia needs to think big and spend big if it wants to be taken seriously.
Now that's an idea to show the world that we are a modern country. We are not Russia with bears, vodka, snow, no. The angle which is common in West for Russia is like a strange country with strange people, with strange culture. Of course, we are different than Anglo-Saxon world, but we are modern country and we are mighty. That's it.
But allegations of corruption have taken some of the shine off these games. Critics of the Kremlin claim that more than a third of the money spent on the Olympics was stolen, siphoned off in the form of bribes and kickbacks. This week, President Putin said he's seen no evidence to prove that. Just a few minutes' drive from the Olympic Park is the seaside. Down on the beach, Ruslan and Alexander are unhappy. Sochi security means that until the Olympics and the Paralympics are over, no fishing boats are allowed into the sea. They've cast their rods from the shore instead. But the mullet just won't bite. And it's making the two fishermen very anti-Olympics. We're worse off now because of these Winter Games, Ruslan says. The environment's been damaged, the fish aren't biting, and the traffic jams are just awful. But when I ask Ruslan if he's planning to visit the Games, he smiles. Oh yes, he tells me. I want to go and see the snowboarding. There are many people in Sochi, like Ruslan, who criticize the Olympics, and yet you can sense there's a little bit of pride there too, that their town, which lived so long behind an iron curtain, is about to welcome the world to a Winter Olympics.
The BBC's Steve Rosenberg.
It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Orlando Arroyo. I'm the head coach of the Phoenix Falcon Fencing Club, and we're having classes and individual lessons. It's a one-on-one sport. It makes your mind go. It keeps you active. It makes you solve problems. You have to solve problems pretty quick. Really, the biggest thing I like it because it's a mind game besides physical. When you fence someone, you're actually in combat with another person who has this long sword pointing at you, and you have to learn how to get around it to get a touch, meaning that you have to hit him. The people who do fencing, after they do it, love it, because it's something about that one-on-one. You're not in a team effort. You're alone up there. When you go to fence someone, it's you and him. And hopefully all the coaching you got will come to avail that you'll win the bout.
That's Rolando Arroyo teaching fencing at Phoenix Falcons Fencing Club. If you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique, send us a note. It's the show at kjzz.org.
Seeing some cloudy skies outside right now. Look for a high of 72, with the clouds likely to stick around through tonight. Overnight low of 50. Partly sunny skies tomorrow, the high of 76. It's 69 degrees right now. It's the show.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jamie McIntyre. President Obama outlined changes in the NSA's surveillance programs in a speech today at the Justice Department. He called for several reforms, including ending the government's control of phone data and requiring court permission to access that data. But he's not saying the NSA should stop its snooping.
The men and women at the NSA know that if another 9/11 or massive cyber attack occurs, they will be asked by Congress and the media why they failed to connect the dots.
The president did order intelligence agencies to stop spying on friendly foreign leaders. And as for who should control the data provided by phone companies, the president gave the intelligence community and the attorney general 60 days to come up with options. One idea is for the phone companies themselves or some neutral third party to keep the data. It's been 9 days since a chemical spill in the Elk River tainted the water supply of some 300,000 West Virginians. And Dave Mistich of West Virginia Public Radio says a do-not-use order has finally been lifted for the last customers.
West Virginia American Water announced that customers in the small community of Clendenin in Kanawha County may begin flushing according to the established guidelines. The flushing process began on Monday, and areas were cleared to use their water one at a time. A chemical known as MCHM leaked from a storage facility owned by Freedom Industries into the Elk River last Thursday, forcing the water ban. Customers in three small communities in Putnam County remain under a do not drink and limited contact notice. Precautionary boil water advisories remain in place for several other smaller groups of customers after water storage tanks were depleted following excessive flushing activities. For NPR News, I'm Dave Mistich in Charleston.
Freedom Industries, the company that's blamed for the spill, has now filed for bankruptcy. In its filing, it says the leaky storage tank appears to have been pierced through at its base by some sort of object. On Wall Street, the Dow closed up 41, S&P fell 7, NASDAQ lost 21. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing exceptionally creative individuals. This year's MacArthur Fellows are at macfound.org.
This is the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Coming up, as of this week, the flu is widespread in Arizona, but it's not the usual patients.
We are noticing that we're seeing it in young adults. With previously, it had been people with high-risk conditions, people who were pregnant, and this time we're seeing it in younger adults. So we are monitoring that.
That's ahead. It's the show.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody.
All right, so think of your very first memory. Got it? Pretty vivid, right?
Hi, this is Andrew from Portland, Oregon. My earliest childhood memory is about being 2 years old. And I locked myself in the closet in my house to hide myself from the babysitter because my parents were out to dinner. And the sense of abandonment was just too overwhelming for me at the time.
Oh, poor Andrew in Portland. So here's a question. Why does his brain remember that experience, aside from the fact that it was pretty intense? And why is much of our childhood kind of wiped out, if you think about it? Can you remember your 7th birthday? 8th? 12th? 4th? Joining us to explain the curious science behind our childhood memories and how they're archived is Patricia Bauer, professor of psychology at Emory University, and the lead author of a study that really looks at this closely. Welcome to the program, Patricia.
Thank you.
So we've been asking people about their earliest memories, and we've been getting some very, very interesting responses. I spoke actually to my 4-year-old last night, and I want to play the memory he claims is his first. But before I do that, what's the brain doing when it selects a first memory, do you think?
Well, that's a very complicated question, and I wish I had a succinct answer to it. The brain is gathering bits and pieces of information that were encoded at the time of the experience. So we sometimes think about memory as a file folder that you simply open up and you read off the contents of the file folder. But really what it is a very distributed representation, distributed across the entire cortex. And to retrieve a memory, what you have to do is recreate the pattern of activation that actually corresponded to the original experience.
Mm. All right, so I sat my 4-year-old down last night, his name is Ajax, and asked him a question. Listen to this little interaction here.
All right. What is the first thing you remember in your life?
The first thing I remember is my life when you were watching the Super Bowl, and all the kids were watching the Super Bowl, and I bumped my head in the corner of the wall.
So you were watching the Super Bowl and you bumped your head?
No. You guys were watching the Super Bowl. I was not.
And then what happened?
I had to go to the hospital.
What did they do with your head?
They got me a shot, but I'm not scared of shots anymore.
That's good. Thank you for that story.
So, Patricia, he's not scared of shots anymore.
That's an important development.
Yeah, you got that story, right?
Yes, I did.
All right, now here's the fascinating piece. We weren't watching the Super Bowl. What we were watching was the returns for Obama's reelection in 2012, but we were gathered in the bed in the exact same way in front of the TV as we would have been for the Super Bowl. So he's already kind of mixed two memories there as a 4-year-old.
Yes, and actually that is very illustrative of one of the differences between children's memories and adults' memories. So one of the things that adults do when we're encoding an experience, we tend to give it a specific time and place tag, as it were. It was the time that we were watching the Super Bowl. We were in the bed in our house in which we lived 2 years ago, etc. We give it a time and place tag that is one of the things that helps us retrieve that memory later on. Those tags tend to be something that children routinely omit from their memories. So it's easy then, therefore, for them to confuse when and where an event took place. And you can see how that would lead to later memory confusion if you can't identify the unique location or timing of an event.
Although he's so confident. I love that. And here, listen to this memory from a Phoenix, Arizona listener. When I was 2, my soon-to-be divorced parents had a fight. I checked with my dad, then walked out to the porch to comfort mom. Can you remember what went on when you were 2?
Well, there are enormous individual differences. The average age at which people identify their first memory, their earliest memory, is somewhere between 3 and 3.5. But within any group of adults, you have very large individual differences. So some adults will have memories from as early as the second year of life.
But your research does show that there's a real turning point at about age 7.
Indeed, it does. So we interviewed a number of children. Many children had conversations with their mothers or fathers when they were 3 years of age. And then we invited them back into the laboratory at different points thereafter, so either 2 years later or as many as 6 years later. And what we found is that the children who came back when they were 5, 6, or 7, they had very good memories for the events that had happened at the age of 3. They remembered a lot of the events. In contrast, the children who came back when they were 8 or 9 years of age had forgotten most of the early events. So that age 7 seems to be kind of an inflection point that we see in the distribution of memories across our lifespan.
Patricia Bauer is professor of psychology at Emory University, lead author on this study of what happens in the brain where we preserve and also lose our childhood memories. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
That's one of our partners. The Takeaway is John Hockenberry.
Arizona now has widespread flu. The state health department made that determination this week. There was a nearly 50% increase in cases this week. Dr. Kara Crist is the health department's chief medical officer.
We look at widespread based on the number of counties and the number of lab results that they have within the counties. So there's not an exact definition, but the reason we went to widespread this week is because all 15 counties were affected by flu.
Now, other states had been widespread in the flu before Arizona for the past few weeks, at least. Is it common that Arizona kind of follows from behind a little bit in this respect?
You know, each flu season is so different that it's hard to say, but we normally hit widespread sometime late January, February.
And how long does the widespread season generally last?
You know, normally it can last through March. That's typically our peak, is the January, February, March time period. But with every flu season, it's different. You know, 2009 was completely different than what we're seeing this time.
And it looks like this is kind of a blast from the past, right, with the predominant strain of the flu that's causing problems for folks.
Right. So 95% of the tests that our lab has done, because our lab can test some of the samples that come in, 95% of them have been the 2009 H1N1 strain.
Can we take any lessons from 2009 and apply them to this year, given that it's the same strain?
You know, flu is always unpredictable. That's the only thing that's predictable about it. And so we have seen the 2009 H1N1 strain since 2009. It's actually been circulating within the community since then. And every year since then, our vaccine has had that in it. So if you're getting vaccinated, you should be relatively protected from it. You know, one of the things that we do monitor is what type of patients we're seeing this in. And so we are noticing that we're seeing it in young adults with previously it had been people with high risk conditions, people who were pregnant, and this time we're seeing it in younger adults. So we are monitoring that because that is a little bit of a change.
As far as the raw numbers go, how do those compare from the declaration of being widespread this year to past years?
You know, when you look, we're not as high as we have been in past years. But it is difficult to take a look at influenza seasons and compare them to past. You know, when you're looking at the 2009 season, which we had a huge bump, we had a lot of publicity around the flu. So people were going in. They were getting tested. People were nervous about the pandemic strain. But right now we're lower than we were in the 2012-2013 year.
Does that tell you anything or give you any kind of indication of how long this year's season might be? I mean, can your crystal ball determine that at this point?
No. I wish it could. I think I'd be famous if I could predict flu. But no, it doesn't really tell us that, because we could get a huge swing, you know, in the next week that could bring us up above. It's so dependent on each flu season.
Dr. Kara Crist is the Chief Medical Officer with the Arizona Department of Health Services.
Sometimes I dream that he is me. Got to see, that's how I dream to be.
That popular Gatorade ad from the early 90s was selling the concept of being like Michael Jordan if you drank what he did. I tried it, still couldn't dunk, and my jump shot remained flat. But the science behind nutritional supplements has seen huge advancements, and High Health has unveiled two new products that it's calling endurance formulas. A release from the company about Hydra X and Hydra XP references the fact that energy demand in high school sports is increasing. So I called Dr. Randon Hall, who works in sports medicine for Phoenix Children's Hospital.
Most of the athletes we're dealing with are not going to play on the collegiate level, and more importantly, are not going to play at the pro and Olympics level. So, you know, in the adolescent age group, with a well-balanced diet, appropriate timing of your eating, those things are the critical things. And I think, based on the research out there, that supplements are really not necessary for a child who is well-nourished and well-educated on nutrition.
How much can we trust that they are up to date on what sort of nutrition they should be taking? Is that something that parents should be very well aware of? Is that something we can trust coaches and trainers to help out with?
You know, that's a good question that you say that, because there was a study out of University of South Carolina that actually looked at collegiate athletes. So those who have made it to the next level, they asked coaches, athletic trainers, strength and conditioning coaches, and then the athletes themselves. They basically asked them a 20-question survey on their basic knowledge of sports nutrition. They determined that if you got 75% correct, you had adequate knowledge. Well, the athletic trainers had about 79%. The strength and conditioning coaches were in the low 80s. But then, interestingly, the coaches, now this is Division 1, 2, and 3 collegiate, were at 35% adequate knowledge, and the athletes themselves were at 9%. So I think we cannot trust at all that adolescents are well-versed on sports nutrition and the appropriate timing, the appropriate amount of macronutrients that they should be taking in preparation from the game. And secondly, I think that, you know, they can't necessarily rely on the coaches as well.
Coming back to sports energy drinks and supplements, is there a thought that there really would be some kind of specialty drink that would really help high school athletes, would be good for high school athletes to take? Are we in a position where, you know, if you drink a lot of water and Gatorade, you're fine that way too?
I want to make a distinction between when you say sports energy drinks, because there are sports drinks and then there are energy drinks. So no one in the medical community that I'm aware of should be advocating energy drinks such as Red Bull or Monster. Those are not seen as advantageous for performance in athletes. At the end of the day, if you have a proper pregame meal, have proper hydration, and some type of electrolyte solution with a small amount of carb for activities that last longer than 60 minutes, you'll be just fine.
Dr. Randon Hall, he specializes in sports medicine at Phoenix Children's Hospital.
Cloudy skies, 69 degrees at KJZZ. It's the show.
KJZZ is supported by Mayo Clinic, where teams of experts work together to focus on you. You can request an appointment or learn which health plans include Mayo Clinic at mayoclinic.org/Arizona.
It's time to head to another hot corner, a valley neighborhood with something going on. As always, let's meet our tour guide.
I'm Gwen Ashley Walters, and I'm a food writer for Phoenix Magazine.
And where have you taken us today?
Today we are in downtown Phoenix, on the corner of Pierce Street and First Street.
So we sit just off the street while early lunchgoers head to some nearby eateries.
Phoenix Public Market Cafe is the newest one, I guess, and it's the biggest draw because it's right next to the downtown Phoenix Public Market, which is a farmer's market, and not just farmer's market, but it's also just a public market that happens on Wednesday evenings and on Saturday mornings. And then this market cafe is opened last year, I believe it opened last May, by Aaron Chamberlain, who owns St. Francis. They're really focused on local, sustainable, family-friendly, I would say, and that's why this market cafe is so special. It's a good price point. It's not really expensive, and it's a wide variety, and they're open 7 days a week from morning till night, and it's just cute as can be.
So we're also, where we're sitting right now, we're next to two restaurants. There's Squash Blossom right in front of us and Pomo to the left of me here.
Right.
What's up with those restaurants?
Squash Blossom is really interesting. They're a breakfast and lunch restaurant, and they specialize in pumpkin pancakes and a lot of vegetarian options. It's tucked back in the way, so you don't really see that when you're on First Street or Pierce Street. It's kind of tucked right behind Pomo. And then Pomo is amazing pizza. Amazing. They were located at the Borgata, but the Borgata is coming down, so they had to find a new home. So they came and opened here downtown, and then they've opened their newest location at Gainey Ranch.
And we're also pretty close to both the old and the new Matt's Big Breakfast. I think a lot of our listeners probably know about
yes.
Matt's Big Breakfast.
They used to have about 20, 25 seats. Now they just moved one block north, and they have about 50 seats there, and they still have a wait. If you remember, you had to wait, I don't know, hour, because they do an astounding job. It's very simple. The menu's not very big, but everything on the menu is perfecto.
So what is it about this particular neighborhood, do you think, that has caused these places to open up here, or to, in Matt's case, to open and then move a little bit further up the road?
I think he wanted more space because he could see that he had a two-hour wait every day. So that was good with that. You know, the actual public Phoenix Public Market that opened was a draw to ASU building down here was a big draw. So there are students who live down here. There's all of the office buildings that are around here. Around the corner from us where we are right now is the Breadfruit. It's a Jamaican restaurant, and the Rum Bar, which is owned by the same people, and it's in fabulous rums actually there. So they've been there since 2008. So there's a lot to do. You've got a lot of choices. You can go to Jamaica, you can go to Italy, or you can just stay American here.
How big of a role do you think the ASU campus, does that help an area like this when it's specifically the students?
It does. I think you have to have foot traffic for restaurants to be successful, and those people live and work here. Well, I guess they don't all live here, but, you know, the light rail, too, so they can come that way.
A lot of the students live down here.
Yeah, and I think, you know, they need to eat somewhere. And I think that's why, I think Aaron Chamberlain at the Public Market Cafe really has aimed for that by opening 7 days a week, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and at a price point that a student can afford.
Do you expect to see more restaurants like that growing up in this area?
Restaurants open all the time. And yes, so I would say there is probably some more on the horizon coming in to this area within the next year.
Does it take a particular kind of restaurant when you're catering to a lot of university people, students, professors, faculty, staff, whatever? Are there certain kinds of restaurants that will be more successful in that area?
Yes. It needs to be accessible. It needs to be affordable. And it needs to be, I call it family friendly, even though there may not be a whole lot of people with kids here. But it needs to, you know, not be pretentious, accessible, just good food at a good price point.
Gwen Ashley Walters, food writer for Phoenix Magazine. We met at the corner of Pierce and First Streets in Phoenix.
When you think of public transit or drive past a bus in Phoenix, art probably isn't the first thing that comes to mind. But Valley Metro is continuing its efforts to change that perception with the 14th annual Design a Transit Wrap contest. Last year's winner, Richard Reed, is now a freshman at ASU. He played off the theme, Do the Ride Thing.
I was trying to think of a visual that could match that tone, and I started drawing shapes, and then I thought of triangles, and then a tessellation. And I thought the tessellation could really speak well to like the positivity of the phrase. And I just needed a color scheme that could match that. And so I chose the colors orange and purple.
Reed says the contest helped give him some direction as he began to look forward to a career.
It would allow me to better utilize the skills that I would need later on in life, like in for graphic design, as far as like the programs and like the techniques and stuff.
Artwork for this year's competition must be submitted to Valley Metro by February 14th. Once it's decided, you'll be able to see the winning design on a bus and light rail train wrap for an entire year. Driving through downtown Phoenix, you may have noticed an unusual rooftop in the middle of a modern city skyline. The yellow steeple and the wrought iron roof ornaments are part of a community from the past.
KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez tells us about Phoenix's historic Block 14.
When the neighborhood block between 7th and 6th Streets in Monroe to Adams was first established, it was considered to be in the outskirts of town. Today, it's a busy section in downtown Phoenix, known as Heritage Square. Did you know Heritage Square is where the last surviving group of residential homes from when Phoenix was first settled?
When Phoenix was originally platted back in the 1870s, it was divided into 98 blocks. This was Block 14.
Michelle Reed is the executive director of the Rossin House Heritage Square Foundation and Guild.
This block is about 118 years old.
The land was purchased by Flora Murray Rossin in 1882. She and her husband, former Phoenix Mayor Dr. Roland Rossin, built a house on the lot, a 10-room, two-story Victorian mansion with a large attic. It had modern amenities, running hot and cold water, electric lights, indoor bathrooms, even on the upper floor, and a telephone.
As Block 14 was developed, the owners of the Rossin House sold different lots on their block. And so as each lot was sold, it was developed.
Reed says that's when Block 14 began to change. California bungalows were built on the square, and later the Cornerstone Mansion was sold. It would eventually change ownership several times, turning it into a boarding and flop house and a multi-unit apartment house until the 1960s. Phoenix purchased the square during a city revitalization program in 1974. The idea was to restore the mansion along with the other homes around it.
During the 1970s, a lot of forensic historians went to great lengths to figure out how it did look. And so they scraped down layers of wallpaper, they scraped up linoleum off the floor, and what they found was even though the house had undergone tons of changes through the years, most of the good bones were still there.
The Victorian house was named the Rossin House after it was restored. The other houses were also named after their original owners. All of them have been converted into museums, shops, restaurants, and office space. There's one interesting story linked to the Rossin House. One of its owners had a daughter who is said to be the first woman to marry when Arizona became a state. She and her fiancé waited for the statehood order to be signed. On February 14, 1912, she had a ring bearer who was dressed as Cupid with a diaper and a bow and arrow. Heritage Square's Michelle Reed says newspaper articles from that time shows the Cupid ring bearer was Barry Goldwater. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez.
We want to hear your ideas and what you know. Send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
When it's unseasonably warm in the valley as it is right now, most baseball fans start daydreaming about spring training. Teams do start reporting to camps early next month.
Tomorrow is part of the first non-football weekend since August. The Society of American Baseball Research, or SABR, marks Sabre Day in 34 cities, including Tempe.
The growth of Sabre is in line with how important statistics have been historically in baseball. But why do stats seem like such a cozy fit for baseball but not for other sports, even football, which has surpassed the popularity of the national pastime?
Sabre President Vince Gennaro says baseball stats are part of American lore, like Joe DiMaggio's hitting streak or Ted Williams' batting average.
Baseball has that unique focus on two individuals at different points in time throughout the game, and that's that batter-pitcher matchup. So while it's really tough to isolate Tony Romo's or Eli Manning's impact on a play or what a pulling guard does to make a sweep productive in football, or what a point guard does in basketball. It's a little bit easier when you've got a pitcher on the mound with the ball in his hand and a batter at the plate.
And Gennaro says there's a new wave of baseball stats that'll make their mark soon.
We've got new technology. We now have Doppler radar-based systems picking up the spin rate of pitches as they approach home plate. Everything from the pitch data to what happens to batted balls when they leave the bat. What is the vertical launch angle, the speed of the ball off the bat? There's a whole world of new world of information out there that's going to help us evaluate players and evaluate how effective teams are.
Vince Gennaro of Sabre on the science and stats of baseball. Our teams, the Reds and Yankees, Mark reports for spring training February 14th, and the Diamondbacks arrive on February 6th, a little earlier because of a spring jaunt to Australia.
A lot of good stuff going on this weekend. For example, if you want some laughs, Sean and Marlon Wayans will be performing their stand-up this weekend at Stand Up Live. That's in Phoenix.
Also, the Fit City Expo tomorrow at Scottsdale Community College from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. You can learn more about getting fit, including watching demos and enjoying healthy food.
If you'd prefer maybe sitting down and watching others exert themselves, the Suns host the Washington Wizards tonight at U.S. Airways Center.
The show was produced this week by John Hoban, Nick Blumberg, and Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, with help from Tiara Vian, Annika Klein, Alexandra Olgan, and Kendra Sabo. Tracy Greer and Julie Levin make up our digital team. Our managing editor, Al Macias, our news director, Peter O'Dowd.
We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. You can hear if you have good story ideas, if you want to send us pictures of your dog, or tell us what baseball team you root for. That's all good. We're at the show at kjzz.org.
For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. This is listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. We hope you have a great weekend. All Things Considered is up next. It's 3 o'clock.